Despite all the efforts to promote healthy eating in recent years, Americans still only eat on average about one serving of fruit each day and less than half of the recommended amount of vegetables. So as families prepare for back to school and thoughts turn to lunch boxes, some grocery chains are making a new effort to entice families into the produce aisle. NPR's Allison Aubrey reports.
Think baby carrots. They're everywhere. And if you want to know how they got so popular, you got to talk to Jeff Dunn. He used to be a top executive at Coca-Cola, but several years back, he left and decided to try something new. He and his marketing buddies looked around a typical grocery store produce aisle.
Well, we said it was boring, you know.
And he saw lots of potential to drive up sales of fresh produce and get kids to eat healthy by using the marketing tactics he learned in the soda industry. So he created a Mountain Dew-style ad campaign for baby carrots.
Brought to you by a bunch of carrot farmers.
The ads are full of fast-paced adventure. In this ad, carrots shoot from a cannon. And Dunn says the strategy has worked. His company, Bolt House Farms, has seen sales of fresh carrots, which were flat 4 years ago, start growing.
So we've been able to turn that trend around really through marketing efforts. So it shows that marketing works.
Since then, more and more healthy products aimed at kids have started appearing on the shelves. There are brightly colored all-fruit smoothies with wacky characters on the bottle, squishy tubes of pureed fruit, and yogurt that you can slurp. And now, in order to get to the next level, Dunn has another idea. He wants to give kids their own go-to destination in the grocery store. Their own section, really, filled entirely with products that are healthy and presented in funky ways. He's been working with retailers, including Walmart and Giant Eagle, to reorganize their produce aisles. And his company has been developing new products to help draw kids in.
Those are cool. I like the smoothies. This is awesome.
That's Peter Dykeman Birmingham. He's 18, not really a kid anymore, but he's lasered in on the latest version of baby carrots. It's not just a bag of carrots. Nope, they come with a little pouch of colorful chili lime seasoning that you can shake onto the carrots. They're spicy, crunchy, and have that flavor that sticks to your fingers. Not quite Doritos, but close. Middle schooler Alex Goley gets it.
They kind of taste better than like any other vegetable.
Alex's mom, Rhonda Goley, says bringing junk food tactics to the healthy stuff makes sense.
Absolutely, because I think it's something that just kind of adds a little more fun to eating it.
David Just of Cornell University, who studies what motivates people to eat better, agrees. Despite concerns about marketing to kids, this combination of making healthy products fun and bringing them all together is spot on.
Yes, I think the kid-friendly snacking stations are an absolutely fascinating concept.
It's what the cereal aisles and candy shelves have been doing for decades, but
this is a tactic and a tool that really hasn't been used to promote healthier foods.
Until now. And if it works, Just says kids might be dragging their parents to hit the produce aisle. Allison Aubrey, NPR News.
Even as we focus most on the immediate and deadly impact of Ebola, the outbreak in West Africa is also starting to have broad and long-term impacts on the region. People who are monitoring the situation say the medical crisis may soon be followed by a food crisis. NPR's Dan Charles has more.
Even before the current outbreak, many people in Sierra Leone, Liberia, and Guinea lived on the edge of hunger, especially at this time of year.
This is a very critical period in Western Africa in general.
That's Shukri Ahmed, a senior economist with the UN's Food and Agriculture Organization, or FAO. This is the lean period. Last week's harvest of rice or groundnuts is mostly gone. This year's harvest is approaching. And until recently, people were quite hopeful about that harvest.
The rainfall situation was very good, and we were actually developing an optimistic forecast for crop production this year.
And then came Ebola. The first food source that disappeared from markets was so-called bush meat, meat from forest animals. Some of those animals, like fruit bats, can actually carry Ebola, so governments have banned it. Other foods have become scarce as a side effect of efforts to keep the virus from spreading. David Mwesigwa, the FAO's representative in Sierra Leone, says when governments stopped people from moving from country to country, or even from one town to another, it stopped traders from delivering food to markets.
The primary impact has been the mobility of most of the traders.
In quarantined areas, some food markets have been shut down completely. Sierra Leone and especially Liberia also import a lot of rice. Those imports are down too. Ships are reluctant to dock in places affected by the epidemic. The result is less food for sale and rising prices. According to Mwesigwa, people in many parts of Sierra Leone are paying 40 or 50% more for rice or other foods. The prices of meat and fish have doubled in some places. The situation in Liberia, he says, is similar, even a little bit worse. So that's hurting people right now. But things may even get worse, because this year's harvest is also in danger, mainly because the traditional communal work arrangements have broken down.
The Ebola came in at a time when farmers were really ready to go to the field and work together in groups.
But people aren't supposed to come together in groups these days. It could spread the disease. So in many places, essential work like weeding the rice is not happening. Gon Myers, the World Food Program's representative in Sierra Leone, says when you take all those factors together,
we think there will be a food crisis even after the Ebola crisis.
There will be a food crisis, you say?
Yes.
Myers and Mwesigwa say their organizations will need to start responding even while the Ebola outbreak continues. Some of this will have to be in the form of aid, getting food to people who've been cut off from their normal supplies. But Mwesigwa from the FAO says he wants to keep food aid to a minimum. Sierra Leone in particular has the potential to grow a lot of food itself, and it's made great progress towards self-sufficiency since the country's civil war ended a decade ago. Mwesigwa says international agencies can help the region's farmers get back on their feet, providing seeds, if those are missing, livestock, so people can produce more of their own meat. That effort to rebuild food supplies, he says, probably will last at least 1 or 2 years. Dan Charles, NPR News.
California's biggest chicken producer, Foster Farms, has been accused in the past of poisoning people selling meat contaminated with salmonella bacteria. Last fall, the U.S. Department of Agriculture threatened to shut down 3 of the company's plants. Since then, Foster Farms has spent millions to get rid of salmonella, and some food safety experts now say the whole poultry industry should follow this example. NPR's Dan Charles has the story.
Bob O'Connor, a senior veterinarian at Foster Farms, wants to show me the salmonella problem up close. So we've come to a ranch near the town of Merced in California's Central Valley. I see dozens of long, narrow chicken houses lined up across acres of dry, bare dirt. We step inside one of the houses. Thousands of little chicks are walking around on the floor. They're 11 days old, cute, healthy looking. But O'Connor says there's a lot you can't see.
I really cannot look at this flock of birds and say to you that, you know, these birds have salmonella in their GI tract.
But you have to assume that some do, he says. Scientists have tested some flocks in the U.S. and Europe and found salmonella in anywhere from 7 to 70% of all live chickens, which is disturbing because people eventually will eat these birds. Fully cooking them does kill the bacteria, but if salmonella on raw chicken gets on your cutting board, for instance, and then on other food, it can make you really sick. So for years now, the poultry industry has been struggling to control salmonella. These chicken houses, for example, are designed to keep out wildlife, like mice or wild birds that carry the bacteria. When chickens are slaughtered, the carcasses are washed with antimicrobial solutions. The USDA says no more than 7.5% of all chicken carcasses coming out of any plant can test positive for salmonella. Foster Farms, which turns out millions of pounds of chicken meat every week, usually does much better than that.
We had 0% on most of our carcass sampling. I mean, if you look back 3-4 years, every sample set, we were 0%.
So Bob O'Connor thought they were doing really well. But then last summer, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention announced there was evidence that chicken from Foster Farms had caused a wave of salmonella infections. More than 600 people had gotten sick. Inspectors from the U.S. Department of Agriculture arrived at Foster Farms plants, and this time they went much further than the standard safety test. Instead of just testing whole chicken carcasses, they took samples of what most consumers actually buy, the cut-up parts, breasts and thighs and wings. And what they found is now shaking up the entire poultry industry. They found salmonella on about 25% of those cut-up chicken parts. David Acheson, former associate commissioner for foods at the Food and Drug Administration, says this turns out to be the pattern at other poultry companies, too. Whole carcasses seem to be free of salmonella. But then it shows up on nearly a quarter of the chicken parts. It's provoking all kinds of questions.
What happened? Did this bug come in from the environment? Did something contaminate it during the process, the equipment, the workers, something weird like that? Or were we missing it the first time?
Probably we were missing it, Acheson says. Here's one theory for how. When those whole carcasses are tested, they've been chilled to 40 degrees. But then they move to another part of the plant where they're cut up, and they get 10 degrees or so warmer. That warmth may release salmonella that were trapped in skin pores of the chilled carcass. And then the process of cutting up the carcass could spread the microbes around, contaminating lots of other chicken parts. No matter how the salmonella got there, though, Foster Farms had to figure out a way to get rid of them. Bob O'Connor says the USDA sent letters threatening to close three of the company's plants.
And we had 72 hours to respond to that, to come up with a plan to control salmonella prevalence on parts.
O'Connor and his colleagues brought in outside advisors, including David Acheson, the former FDA official who now works as a consultant to food companies. And they went searching for the cause of their problem. They tested slaughtered chickens and picked up a clue. Birds that grew up on some farms were much more likely to carry salmonella than birds from other farms. One of those farms was the one that Bob O'Connor has taken me to visit today.
This particular farm seemed to have more prevalence for salmonella.
Some food safety experts thought the salmonella might be invading the chicken houses from outside, carried by mice or birds or beetles. So the company tested for salmonella on the dirt near these houses and in the green irrigated fields nearby.
Those are vineyards that you passed by right there. There's an almond orchard right there. That's where we went. We literally drag swabbed, you know, through that almond orchard, through that vineyard.
But they discovered the further they moved from the chicken houses, the less salmonella they found. The contamination was concentrated in the houses. It seems that at some point, the bacteria got established inside these houses and then infected each new flock of chickens that came to live here. Those bacteria had to go.
So the interventions that we did for broilers was to really focus on cleaning up the houses themselves.
They attacked this chicken house, the one that's now filled with little chicks.
The whole entire house was soaped down. Then you disinfect it. Then you let it sit. So we let these farms sit for probably at least about 6 weeks without any birds in them.
Foster Farms did a lot of other things, too. It made sure that the breeding hens in their hatcheries were salmonella-free, because if those hens have salmonella, their chicks probably will, too. The company put more money into vaccination, spent more time washing equipment in processing plants. It all took months, but it made a difference. The amount of chicken parts that tested positive for salmonella fell from 20% to less than 5%. David Acheson, the former FDA official, says that's really good. It's setting a new safety standard for the whole industry. Others, like attorney Bill Marler, who makes his living suing food companies when their food makes people sick, say it's not good enough.
The standard is it's still okay to have a pathogen on your product that can sicken and kill your customers. And as long as that's the way it is, we're always going to limp from outbreak to outbreak to outbreak.
Marler says the USDA should take the same stand against salmonella that it did against another dangerous microbe, disease-causing E. coli. When the USDA declared these E. coli bacteria illegal adulterants in food, the meat industry complained, but it also found new ways to prevent E. coli from poisoning people.
It used to be 90% of my law firm's revenue, and now it's nearly zero. It's a success story.
Eliminating salmonella altogether would be difficult. It's much more common in the environment than disease-causing E. coli. So for now, the USDA is asking companies to reduce salmonella contamination, but it's not requiring chicken meat to be completely salmonella-free. Dan Charles, NPR News.
Americans are drinking less orange juice than they used to. OJ sales last year hit the lowest level in more than a decade. There are many reasons for this. Orange juice production is down, prices are up, and competition from other drinks is increasing. All of this has left Florida orange growers wondering about their industry's future. NPR's Greg Allen reports from Miami.
The year was 1969.
What? Ooh. Orange juice with natural vitamin C from the Florida sunshine tree.
In TV commercials, spokesperson Anita Bryant reminded Americans that breakfast without orange juice is like a day without sunshine. Today, nearly all of Florida's oranges are still squeezed for juice, but there are many fewer oranges. Last season, Florida produced just over 100 million boxes, less than half the amount produced 10 years ago. The main reason is citrus greening, a disease that's affected nearly every orange grove in Florida. In Claremont, Florida, Matt McLean points out how greening is affecting his orange trees.
Small fruit, not sizing, a little misshapen. You'll see the green.
So you can tell just because from the size right away?
Yeah, most of the time you can tell that it's too small and it's not sizing. A lot of it's still green while the rest of it's color broke.
McLean grows oranges without pesticides for his Uncle Matt's organic orange juice brand. He uses organic nutrients, compost, and botanical oils to help control the disease. But he says greening is taking a toll.
For the first time in our 15-year history, we've had to import product outside of Florida.
With not enough available in Florida, Uncle Matt's is now also using organic oranges grown in Mexico and California. As production has declined, the price of orange juice has gone up, taking it off many breakfast tables. For many, orange juice is becoming more of an optional luxury drink.
Today, that's just a fact.
Marty McKenna is an orange grower and chairman of the Florida Citrus Commission. McKenna says citrus greening is just part of the problem. Orange juice is still far and away America's best-selling juice. But today, consumers have many other juice and beverage options. McKenna says rising orange juice prices have provided competitors with an opening.
We do have a loss of shelf space, and, you know, a grocery store is going to fill that shelf space with something. So competition is much, much keener now than what it ever has been.
The industry, along with the state and federal governments, are spending millions of dollars on research looking for an answer to citrus greening. In the meantime, Florida growers are grappling with another industry problem, charges by some researchers that because of the amount of fructose they contain, orange and other fruit juices can promote childhood obesity. Barry Popkin, a professor of nutrition at the University of North Carolina, says numerous studies have looked at the health impact of fructose and fruit juice. The results, he says, are convincing.
Every study that followed people for more than a day for years has shown an adverse effect on cardiovascular health from fruit juice that's equal or more powerful than that of soft drinks.
Many doctors now recommend limiting the amount of fruit juice children consume each day. The citrus industry cites its own studies, which it says show for children that orange juice can be part of a healthy diet. To get that message out, Florida's Department of Citrus is working on a new public relations campaign. Public Relations Director David Steele says the industry group is working with Marvel Comics to update its Captain Citrus character.
We will be bringing out not only a live-action figure, but also a printed comic book and a couple of digital-only comic books. The comics will feature Captain Citrus along with the Avengers, which is, of course, one of Marvel's famous properties.
Along with battling evildoers, there will be a message, of course, about how orange juice can be part of every superhero's healthy diet. Greg Allen, NPR News, Miami.